nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, good afternoon. My name is David Janes. I'm a faculty member here in electrical and computer engineering at Purdue. And today I would like to talk on the topic of nanoelectronic interfaces. So I really wanted to do a few things in this talk, and I'll be focusing primarily here on the topic of metal semiconductor interfaces, which I think is an interesting problem that's relevant to many devices, particularly electronic in this size scale. So I want to briefly overview some of the metal semiconductor device contact studies and issues there, talk about what an ideal metal semiconductor interface barrier would look like, in particular looking at band diagrams of those, and then talk about what happens in practice with non-ideal metal semiconductor barriers. I want to then talk about some of the techniques that have been used to control the interfacial barriers between metal and semiconductors, and then talk about some things that are relevant, particularly at the nanoscale, in particular looking at metal molecule semiconductor as a representative device in a class of metal insulator semiconductor devices. So I want to first of all take a minute and talk about the relevance of all this. Why would you care about a metal semiconductor interface? And in electronic devices, there are several places where you might particularly care about it. One is in the topic of ohmic contacts. And the example I've shown here is actually looking at the source-drain contacts in a MOSFET, where, as you're all probably familiar, the oxide region underneath the gate of a MOSFET allows you to draw a charge to an inversion layer in the channel here. And at the ends, in the source and drain, there's actually contacts where you want to have good ohmic contact, that is low resistance contact between a metal and the semiconductor region. In this case, it's an N-channel device, which means you'll have N-plus source and drain regions. For reference, if you want to have good contact resistance, you typically mean a specific contact resistance that's below about 10 to the minus 7 ohms centimeter squared. If you want to achieve that, you need either a low barrier height or heavy doping. In particular, you want these things so you can get into tunneling or thermionic field emission modes of operation. Those are the physical processes you'd need to actually get that kind of contact resistance. And this is also relevant to most other semiconducting devices you can think about. In particular, if you want to build an optoelectronic device like a laser or a light-emitting diode, ohmic contacts are big issues there. If you want to try to build a bipolar transistor, a p-n junction diode, etc., these ohmic contacts are quite important. Another place where you'd use them, where it's more directly visible what you're going to do, is if you actually try to use a Schottky barrier as an active part of your device. And a good example of this is actually looking at the gate region in a metal semiconductor field effect transistor, MESFET. And so in this case, you would be making a direct metal to semiconductor contact. So here you have gate metal sitting in intimate contact with the semiconductor region. And the actual operation of the device involves modulating the depletion region here, which in turn modulates the open channel width here. So instead of thinking this as a device with a conductive channel as an interface, you want to think about it as a device with a buried channel down here. And the real operation of this is to modulate the channel by modulating the depletion width underneath the Schottky barrier. And typically here you would want something with low leakage, so you would want to have very little gate current flowing through this. So in that case you need a moderate barrier height and generally moderate doping underneath the gate region. And this would also be relevant if you wanted to build just a straight Schottky diode. Instead of building a three-terminal transistor, if you want to just build a two-terminal diode, Schottky diodes are quite useful as high-frequency rectifiers because in contrast to p-n junctions, you can get high-frequency operation because there aren't really minority carriers being injected that you'd have to wait to dissipate later on. So I want to start with, first of all, a view of what an ideal metal semiconductor interface should look like, and start with band diagrams here. So if I think about the band diagrams for metals and semiconductors, on the left I draw the band diagram for a metal, and there's two characteristic energies you would normally think about with the metal. There's the Fermi level, that would tell you about the filling of the bands up to a certain position in the semiconductor or in the metal, and then a vacuum level, which would tell you the energy to which you'd have to take a carrier to actually have it be free of the metal. And the distance between those two, the vacuum level down to the Fermi level, is the work function of the metal. For most metals we think about, this is somewhere between about 4 eV and say 5 or 5.5 eV. If you think about an N-type semiconductor, a semiconductor in general, but in this case illustrated based on an N-type semiconductor, you would have a conduction band and a valence band and some Fermi level whose position within those bands would depend on the doping level in the material. And now the characteristic equivalent of a work function is an electron affinity chi, which tells you the difference between the conduction band and the vacuum level in this material. And again, the actual position of the Fermi level with respect to this vacuum level will depend both on that electron affinity of the material, but also whether you dope it N-type or P-type and how heavily you dope it. As we go along, we'll take advantage of the fact that the electrostatic potential in the material is related to the vacuum level. And in fact, to make it exact, you would say that Q times the voltage, Q times the electrostatic potential, is equal to minus E vac. So if we want to think about offsets and the potential, we can just look at that vacuum level. Now, if you bring these two together, if you actually make an intimate junction between the metal and the semiconductor, you wind up generally with band bending at the semiconductor due to the fact that there is an effective work function offset between these two sides. So now we've drawn it such that the metal is on the left, the semiconductor is on the right, and now we have intimate contact between the two. What's going to happen in general is you will have some band bending in the semiconductor due to that work function offset. As a matter of fact, we can make it quantitative. We can say that the barrier height indicated here by the Q phi b, recall it's a barrier height from the Fermi level of the metal up to the conduction band edge in the semiconductor at the interface. And that's going to be given by basically the offset and effective work function. So on the left side, the work function is Q phi m. It's just the work function of the metal. On the right side, the distance from the conduction band edge in the bulk down to the Fermi level in the bulk will be the electron affinity plus an adjustment for EC minus EF in the bulk. And EC minus EF is the term that will depend on the doping. So this is what will happen. In an ideal semiconductor, you'll have to actually have a barrier at the semiconductor interface that's dictated by that offset and effective work functions between the two sides. This will give rise to a depletion region at the interface that's typically on the order of a few nanometers to a few hundred nanometers, depending on the exact barrier height and the doping density in the semiconductor. And eventually, then, you'll reach a bulk region in the semiconductor where the Fermi level position with respect to the conduction band or valence band is dictated by the bulk doping of the material. So this is what we would call an ideal metal semiconductor junction. Notice that we haven't drawn any interfacial states at the interface. We haven't drawn any excess charge other than the charge that was uncovered, in this case, by ionized donors within that depletion region. This gives rise to what's known as sort of the ideal Schottky limit. If we look at the metal semiconductor barrier height on one axis versus the metal work function on another axis, and this is drawn for an N-type semiconductor, we would expect to have a slope in this case of 1. As you may recall, if you're going from electron volts into volts, that is from energy into potential, the conversion is essentially a 1 volt per EV. And so the ideal Schottky limit says, first of all, you would have a slope of 1 volt per electron volt on this curve. And secondly, you would go through 0 barrier height when you'd matched up the two work functions. That is, when Q phi m was equal to the electron affinity plus this adjustment for EC minus EF in the bulk. So this would be what you'd expect. As you change the work function of the metal, you would expect to be able to change that barrier height up and down, as a matter of fact, to take it negative, to take it positive as you went along. Just while we're here, most of the things I'll talk about will be on N-type material, but if you thought about the same thing for P-type semiconductors, you would have this going the other way. You would actually have the barrier height for holes in this case that would get larger as you went to smaller work functions, and at some point you would cross through 0. And then could actually take this on to a negative work function. Now the point at which it crosses through 0 also takes into account the band gap of the semiconductor, so now you sort of have an effective Fermi level position in the semiconductor that's down near the valence band edge. So this basically says that for N-type materials, you would like to have small work function metals, low work function metals to make good contacts, good low barrier contacts. For P-type semiconductors, you would like to have high work function metals to make reasonable contacts to them. And those general ideas are still true, but it's very rare that you actually get exactly this behavior. If you actually look at what happens in real metal semiconductor barriers, there's lots of effects that come into play where you don't quite get that barrier height you would have expected. And one of them that I'd like to talk about is Fermi level pinning. So this is what really happens in a real barrier. If you look at that actual barrier height that you would measure from the metal semiconductor interface, you actually get a plot where the vertical axis here is, again, that Schottky barrier height. The horizontal axis is the metal work function. We've plotted on here what the ideal Schottky limit should look like, that 45-degree slope. And the solid curves that are shown on here are actually measured data points that my student Saurabh Lodha did as part of his master's thesis, actually, where the actual measured Schottky barrier height changes very little with the metal function. In this case, we've changed the metal work function by almost 1.5. And that's given rise to changing the Schottky barrier height. And so what you see is that you get essentially this barrier height for the metal work function you've put down on that surface. So instead of getting this ideal Schottky limit of a slope of about 1, you now get a slope that's less than 1/10. So we can look at sort of an energy band picture of why that happens. On the left, we show again just sort of that metal semiconductor overall band diagram where we see the full depletion region. But if you zoom in on the region right near the interface, you can blow that up and now plot what we have kind of on the lower right here, where you now have the Fermi level in the metal, you have the work function in the metal, gets you up to the vacuum level in the metal. And on the left side of the interface, you now have what looks like a discontinuous jump in the vacuum level. And in fact, what really happens is that you have a large density of interface states distributed throughout the band gap. So if you think about right at the surface between the metal and the semiconductor, at least in a narrow region there, say in the order of a nanometer or so in thickness, you now have a very large density of states. A large density of states, many of which are below the Fermi level, they will be filled with electrons, and therefore you'll have net charge there. Net charge gives rise to essentially a sheet of charge you can think about. And so if you look at the electrostatics of the problem, it means an offset in potential, which, as we said, means an offset in vacuum level in this case. So this is the net effect, that you basically, if you look at an expanded view of that interface, instead of now matching up to have the vacuum level be sort of continuous in a large scale, it looks like there's a discontinuity in the vacuum level. But notice that it's not really discontinuous microscopically. It still follows our normal rules of potential being continuous. It's just we've gone through a sheet charge there. So these states are at the interface between the metal and the semiconductor. As I said before, they're distributed throughout the band gap. And they tend to have, in materials where you see strong Fermi level pending, you tend to get densities of states at that interface that are in the order of 10 to the 14th states per square centimeter per electron volt. Because they're distributed out through the band gap, you now have to specify sort of an energy width of those states. And this would be true, say, on N-type gallium arsenide, if you look at the metal semiconductor interface there. Now, you contrast this with something like 10 to the 15th atoms per square centimeter on the surface of a semiconductor crystal like gallium arsenide, and that says to first order you have about one state per EV for every 10 atoms that are on that surface. So it's a relatively large density of states there. The states below the Fermi level are filled, but because this is such a large density of states, the surface potential doesn't change much with respect to the charge neutrality position, even if you try to uncover a lot of charge there. And the net effect of this is you see the vacuum level step up fairly radically at the interface, but still be microscopically continuous. And the reason that it doesn't change much with metal work function is because of this idea that you can perturb that amount of charge there fairly strongly without moving the energy very much. So the net effect is you see an energy with respect to the conduction or valence band edge that remains relatively constant regardless of what you do in the metal. So this is the basic physics behind Fermi level pinning, a large density of states, a large density of charge states at that interface. Okay. Now, it would be fair to say that in the field, there's not strong agreement as to exactly the physical origin of those states. Everybody agrees that Fermi level pinning comes about because you have this large density of interface states there, but then things start diverging about what your actual explanation is about the physical origin of those states. And to make a rather complicated argument more simple, there's basically two types of explanations out there. And the first I will broadly classify as being intrinsic effects. And these are things where you'd say, regardless of how you prepare the interface, the mere fact you have a metal to semiconductor interface will lead to these large densities of states. And one example of that is a theory called metal-induced gap states, which essentially says that you have a very high density of states in the metal, you have a much lower density of states in the semiconductor, and so over a fairly narrow region, sort of the states in the metal will penetrate into the semiconductor surface and give rise to states there simply because of that large transition in states. If you believe this whole idea of intrinsic effects, then you would have to say that there's sort of little or no dependence on the surface preparation. It doesn't really matter what you did to that interface. You should get those same basic states there. The second broad camp of explanations really says that it's more an extrinsic effect. That is, it matters quite a bit how you prepared that state. So it would be associated with the exact chemistry on the surface, if you had surface oxidation, other dangling bonds, etc. And this would predict that there was significant dependence on the surface preparation. So there may be mixtures of both of these things in an average contact, but you should be able to at least propose or think about some experiments where you could be able to sort of separate things that were intrinsic from things that depended on how the surface was prepared. So while we're here, we should note that there have been a number of experiments conducted where people have tried to look for these kinds of effects. And those, you can broadly say, are one of two kinds of experiments. You could either do in situ processing, and that's illustrated on the top here, where you try to do things without ever exposing the sample to air or other contaminants in between the time you actually grew this semiconductor layer on the surface and the time you put the metal down. And so the example here would be within one vacuum chamber. You do this in an ultra-high vacuum system, for instance. You have an epitaxial growth technique where you grow a clean layer of the semiconductor. And then without ever breaking vacuum, without ever bringing this thing out into the air, you actually evaporate a metal contact on the top. In principle, you would have an atomically clean interface where you did not have other contaminants due to oxidation or other species on the surface. And in many cases, you will actually have some kind of surface reconstruction. For instance, you'll form dimer rows on the surface that would bond together instead of just having open dangling bonds there. The second broad category of experiments, and the thing we would normally use for device processing, so it's actually a very relevant example, is ex situ processing. And that would involve having the sample exposed to atmosphere between the time that the semiconductor surface was formed and the time you actually put down a metal contact. So, for instance, you would have the epitaxial growth in a vacuum chamber. You would bring the sample out of that vacuum chamber, and then you would do the normal things you would try to do to a sample. You would have it be exposed to photoresist chemicals to actually do patterning on the surface. It would be exposed to the air in this process time, so you'd actually form oxide layers on the surface or have other reactions on the surface. You would then oftentimes actually do a chemical strip of the oxide, so actually put into a chemical solution to try to etch off the oxide layer. But the key thing to remember is that many of these surfaces reoxidize fairly quickly. By the time you get it out of your etch beaker, dry it off, and into your metallization system and start the pump down to get the vacuum again, you've already significantly oxidized the surface. So we can think about these ex situ techniques as being more akin to what we do in standard device fabrication, standard device processing, but also the surface is rarely this atomically clean, chemically pure surface. So this leads us to ask, what could that surface look like when we're actually doing this? And there's a number of things that you could think about the surface doing, and there's a number of techniques that have actually been employed to try to look at it. People have done optical studies of, say, the band bending near a surface to try to understand electrically what it's looking like. They've done chemical studies of what the surface chemistry is at various stages after it's been exposed to air. They've done things like scanning probe microscopy measurements to actually try to directly measure the surface potential. And this does include both the in situ and the ex situ kind of fabrication techniques. So if you think about these ex situ processing techniques where you deposit metal after the surface is exposed, you can think about the various things that have happened to it. And they're kind of outlined on the left here. There's probably a surface reconstruction that happens in most semiconductors after growth, immediately after it's done growing. You could certainly have dangling bonds. If you think about the whole idea of how we got band structure in our semiconductors to begin with, it was due to the fact we had periodic lattices where you could think about wave functions going through the semiconductor. Now all of a sudden you reach a termination point. So you have things where you have unsatisfied bonds. Instead of having the four nearest neighbors that are typical in most of these tetrahedral bonding arrangements, you would get to a point where there was sort of an unsatisfied bond someplace. And you also have oxidation. We know that many surfaces, including silicon and gallium arsenide, form native oxides fairly quickly on exposure to air. And so you now have some combination of gallium, say, bonded to oxygen, arsenic bonded to oxygen on, say, a gallium arsenide surface, for instance. So this leads to processes that we might use where we first deposit a metal on the surface, and then we do some subsequent annealing or alloying to try to change that surface again. So I wanted to spend a few minutes at least talking about some processes or procedures we'd use to try to control these interfacial barriers at both the micron scale and also the nanoscale. So there's a few simple things you could do to try to steer around this. If we argue that, say, if we're going to process a 3-5 semiconductor, and we always get this Fermi level pinning at the metal semiconductor interface. That may limit the kind of contact resistance we can get and a few other things. So one of the things we could do is just try to play games with the size of the contacts. And you actually see this fairly often in experimental device development, where people will say, I've developed a transistor that has a 10 nanometer active cluster at the middle that gives me single electron charging effects. And if you stop and look at the overall device is many microns in extent. And part of that is because of the need to make reasonable ohmic contacts on the side. So you could say, well, I'll just live with whatever specific contact resistance I can get from the actual interface, and then I will try to make my contacts sufficiently large. I don't have to worry about it. This winds up limiting your integration density. If the contact sizes start dominating your overall device, then you can't ever really downscale the devices that far. The second thing you can do to get back to one of our examples of, say, the MESFET, is to adjust the channel doping and thickness to compensate for whatever the Schottky barrier height is you actually got. So whatever it wound up being, you can just adjust your overall device parameter to try to readjust the actual on current or threshold voltage, etc. One of the other things we do, especially in ohmic contacts, is we alloy these things, or in particular, we just anneal them, and that oftentimes leads to alloying. So on the top, we illustrate how we might normally go about this. This is, an example on N-type gallium arsenide, which is a semiconductor where we know Fermi-level pinning is a specific problem. In this case, one of the common recipes for making good ohmic contacts to it is what's generically known as a gold-germanium-nickel contact. That winds up being an evaporation of a sequence, depending on your favorite recipe, of some combination of nickel, gold, and germanium in thin layers. Then typically a cap layer of something like titanium, and finally a thicker gold layer on top of that. And by and large, the titanium is there just as a diffusion barrier to keep the rest of the structure in place as you anneal this thing. When you first evaporate that, remember we have a layer that most likely has a surface oxide on it, so you can really think of it as sort of a gold germanium nickel stack sitting on top of an oxide layer. In order to actually activate this thing as a good ohmic contact, what we do is we then put it into an annealing furnace, and we anneal it at a temperature of somewhere around 400 degrees C. What that does is it helps us break through that surface oxide, so you have some reactivity of the metals through that oxide, but you also wind up having a diffusion into the material. It actually creates a new metallurgical interface, actually creates spikes that go down into the semiconductor layer itself. So now instead of having a planar surface that was the original semiconductor surface, you now get this distributed surface with a series of spikes, and that does a couple things. It first of all creates a new metallurgical interface that wasn't susceptible to the oxidation or other effects you had. It also increases your effective area. Now you, instead of having just a planar area, you now have sort of the surface area of an inverted mountaintop, and so you can actually increase your effective area. And it also likely induces a fairly high doping density right near the interface. Note that it actually, in the process, consumes semiconductor material. If you had a very shallow device layer, suppose you were trying to put a device channel just, say, 10 nanometers or 20 nanometers below that surface, you likely would have spiked this metallization all the way through it. So you have to be careful using this if you're actually trying to have a very shallow device in it. There's a fourth thing that you can do that has been used in particular to try to keep surfaces stable in between intermediate processes, and that's actually do some kind of a surface treatment. This is analogous to the kind of thing that happens in a MOSFET process where you actually hydrogen terminate the silicon to silicon dioxide interface to try to lock up those interface states. One of the examples that's been used out there is actually trying to do elemental sulfur passivation of gallium arsenide, and the cartoon here shows that basic idea. You, instead of just having dangling bonds and random termination at your semiconductor surface, you actually expose this thing to a chemical solution and or just elemental sulfur to actually form sulfur bonds at the surface. And this helps to prohibit instant surface oxidation, but it doesn't tend to be stable indefinitely. It tends to eventually reoxidize. But it's useful as a surface layer when you're taking out of one vacuum system, when you want to go into another vacuum system, or other techniques like that. Okay. So what are some of the challenges if you really want to think about extending this to nanometer scale devices? First of all, typically we're dealing with fairly small physical interfaces. The structures we want to deal with, say nanowires, molecular components, nanotubes, etc., would oftentimes be small both laterally and vertically. So we can't necessarily use those ideas where we'd spike deep into it. We oftentimes have very large surface-to-volume ratios, and this is something that if you're trying to build a sensor or a catalyst particle is great, but is not necessarily particularly good if you're trying to control a semiconductor device structure. And in particular, you may have to work hard to even find a bulk region in some of these things. And as we look at this, then, we're also starting to think about new kinds of fabrication approaches. You want to have things with, say, nanowires, where you have preformed nanowires that were formed, say, in a chemical solution, and you want to bring those into a device structure. You want to look at self-assembled structures, things where you didn't have to go in and actually start with a large semiconductor crystal and lithographically define it out. For many of these things, you may have relatively limited thermal budgets. If you try to heat this thing up to the typical anneal temperatures that we used for, say, the gold germanium nickel contacts, you may wind up destroying some of your interface layers. You may wind up degrading your nanowires in a significant way. So we want to think about processes where we don't need those deep annealing or heavy spiking contacts in place. We actually did some work a few years ago where we were trying to develop interfaces that could be applied by self-assembled networks. The gold regions in the middle were supposed to be metal nanoclusters. We were trying to achieve each of these integrated onto sort of a standalone semiconductor mesa that would give us negative differential resistance type effects, sort of a resonant tunneling diode type effects. And if you start looking at this kind of idea and drawing these to scale, we could get metal nanoclusters that were down in the range of, say, 5 to 10 nanometers and could certainly do arrays of those. But if you started trying to draw the typical semiconductor ohmic contact, on the top we have here illustrated sort of the standard gold germanium nickel alloyed contact. And on the right, sort of to scale, or maybe not even yet to scale, the size of these metal nanoclusters we could look at. So we could actually make semiconductor device interfaces where if you just put the nanoclusters down on the surface, you would wind up with a fairly substantial dead layer on the surface. That is, the typical surface depletion region width we talked about of being tens to hundreds of nanometers. If you really did try to build a contact structure that was, say, 10 nanometers or 20 nanometers or even 100 nanometers, you'd pretty quickly wind up with a situation where that surface dead layer, that depletion region at the surface, was much larger than the actual size of the devices or the contacts you were trying to make. And now if you try to apply these ideas of alloying the contacts, you will have destroyed the thing that actually was giving you that small device island to begin with. So those didn't seem to be particularly attractive ideas. So what we started looking for was ways where you could actually control the surface and have a well-defined metal semiconductor interface with the desired low barrier height properties without actually having to go through things like annealing or destruction of the original interface and reformation of a buried interface. Another example that comes up is some more recent work we've done actually with zinc oxide nanowires. And in this case, the picture on the right is actually an SEM image of the nanowire itself. And one of the things that becomes obvious there is that oftentimes you're sort of restricted in how big your contact can be. If you define a specific diameter of nanowire to get the channel region you wanted, many times the overall diameter of your contact is going to be the same as the diameter of your active channel. So you really can't play these games with making sort of arbitrarily large or arbitrarily sized channels. You really are sort of stuck with the cross-section that you made for your device itself. So again, you have to live with sort of the geometry you had rather than trying to flare this thing out and take advantage of some geometry effect. So I wanted to spend a little time talking about some things we've done where we think we can understand how to control the metal semiconductor barriers using cap layers of semiconductors and then sort of as deposited metal. So we can try to control that barrier height by changing the metal but without doing things like an alloying or destruction of the original interface. So the case study I want to go through is actually using a chemically stable cap layer. This is on N-type gallium arsenide. So remember, N-type gallium arsenide is a material where you get Fermi-level pinning, you get very little change in Schottky barrier height if you put a metal directly on it. And so we're dealing with N-type gallium arsenide layers, but now we're putting on thin cap layers on the order of a few nanometers, 2 to 5 nanometers of a material that I'll talk about in a minute. It's actually low-temperature grown gallium arsenide. And we've looked at studies of both unmetallized surfaces to understand what this open surface looks like, but also of contact studies. Look at Schottky barriers, ohmic contacts, etc. But all of them that I'll talk about are really as deposited metallization. We have not done annealing on these things. So low temperature grown gallium arsenide is an interesting material. It's actually gallium arsenide that's grown by molecular beam epitaxy, but it's grown at much lower than normal substrate temperature. So normal molecular beam epitaxy would be at, say, 600 degrees C. That would give rise to stoichiometric material. We have one gallium for every arsenic. In this case, it's actually grown at temperatures down in the range of 250 to 350 degrees C. And what that does is it gives you about 1% excess arsenic. So one of the ways to think about it is instead of as gallium 1, arsenic 1, you could think about it as being gallium 0.995 and arsenic 1.005. That would be about the way to think about it. This large density of excess arsenic gives rise to a mid-gap band of states, which is illustrated on the right here. Here you see a conduction band and valence band in this material. This red distribution is actually a representation of the mid-gap band of states. It's at the order of about 10 to the 20th states per cubic centimeter, so it's a relatively high density of states. And it gives rise to a bulk Fermi level pinning that's at a point about 0.4 eV below the conduction band edge. So there's so many excess states in the material, it actually pins the Fermi level in the bulk material. You can change that a little bit by doping, but it really is kind of pinned out there in the middle of the gap. This large density of excess states, which by the way are primarily arsenic anti-site defects, give rise to a very short minority of carrier lifetime in this material, and because the Fermi level is pinned above mid-gap, these are minority carriers or holes. This in turn leads to inhibited surface oxidation in the material. So now you have a material that's somewhat more chemically stable than standard gallium arsenide. Okay. So we've actually used this material as a surface or interface material on top of stoichiometric gallium arsenide. And remember, we're talking about very thin layers of this. So the bulk of the depletion regions we talk about would be in stoichiometric gallium arsenide. And this is just a very thin cap layer on the surface in comparison to any thickness of a depletion region. So one of the things we looked at was just the open surface. Instead of metallizing it, there are techniques available, and this particular one was done using an atomic force microscope, where you can actually measure the surface potential of these things in a non-contact technique. And what was done here was that thin layer of gallium arsenide, low-temperature grown gallium arsenide, was put on top of a stoichiometric layer of gallium arsenide. We measured the surface potential, and you notice that at T less than zero is the material just sitting there. It's got a native oxide on it. Whatever it's doing has long since evolved. And we get a surface potential on the order of 350 millivolts. At T equals zero, we actually put this thing into a chemical etch to strip off that oxide, bring it back out of the etch and start measuring again, and you notice that we see this transient of about a quarter of a volt in surface potential, and then a decay over, in this case, actually several hours back to sort of the normal pinned position. So the interpretation of this is at T less than zero, the surface is pinned. It's got enough defect states or interfacial states due to the surface oxidation that the surface Fermi level is pinned. At T equals zero plus, we now have unpinned the surface, have actually dropped actually, in this case, raised the barrier height fairly dramatically, and then at long times, we decay back to that original pinned position. So this indicates that we actually have a fairly long time. Remember, we said in standard semiconductor processing, once you've stripped the oxide, within just a few seconds, it's sort of reoxidized. This has an electrical activity that lasts many hours beyond that time. And this is in correspondence or in agreement with some earlier studies we've done where you can actually see chemically that surface reoxidizes fairly slowly with time constants on the order of hours. Okay. So this is consistent with some other experiments that have been done where you can show that the open surface is not intrinsically pinned before you actually start putting metal on it. The next question is, once we've actually evaporated metal on it, is that still true? Can we still have an unpinned surface? So in order to look at that, we actually did capacitance voltage measurements. And I won't go into a great detail here, but what we did was we metallized the surface. You see the annular rings on the top there. We actually have a center contact that's the measurement lead, and then a surrounding large area contact that gives you the effective back contact or ground. If you look at the classic theory for how a Schottky barrier should look, if you plot 1 over C squared versus voltage, you should wind up with a curve where the slope tells you something about the doping density in the semiconductor region of the Schottky, and the intercept tells you about the barrier height. In particular, you can extract the barrier height from the expression shown here. So you can actually directly measure that semiconductor barrier height this way. It turns out this one's a little bit complicated because you have that interfacial layer with a lot of mid-gap states, so there's a relatively large amount of charge density in that cap layer itself. But if you look at these plots of 1 over C squared versus V, you see, if you extrapolate to a barrier height, you see both in terms of the uncorrected barrier height and also the corrected barrier height taking into account those charge states in the low-temperature grown gallium arsenide, that you've been able to change the barrier height by changing the metal. In this case, we looked at three metals with various work functions, and we were able to see actually changes in the barrier height. And if you plot that up now, the colored curves here represent the measured barrier heights in those three different metals. So now we have three different work functions. You see a fairly substantial change in measured Schottky barrier. So instead of that pinned condition we had where you get less than 0.1 volt change in barrier height, we now have changes in barrier height that are over 0.6 volts. And this is all due to a 3 nanometer thick cap layer on that surface. So essentially 30 angstroms of material on that surface has allowed you to change the characteristics of that Schottky barrier pretty dramatically. We still don't have complete unpinning. We still don't follow exactly the ideal Schottky limit, but at least we've been able to change that characteristic pretty radically. So now if you wanted to, say, build barrier heights in N-type gallium arsenide between about 0.5 and 1.2 volts, you could do that using these approaches. By the way, the two different color curves are two different doping densities within that thin cap layer on the surface, one being beryllium, which is typically a p-type dopant, and the other being unintentionally doped layers. And we can understand, based on the charge neutrality positions in there, why we get differences between those two curves. So if you look a little bit more detail, remember I said that the thing that gives rise to Fermi-level pinning to begin with is a large density of surface states. We can look at these various curves and back out from them what the density of states is. In particular, if you look at the middle column here, that tells you the density of surface states in states per square centimeter per electron volt. And for the standard N-type gallium arsenide, where we got that strong pinning, we were at about 10 to the 14th states there. And if we look at the two samples on the low-temperature grown gallium arsenide, where we get much less pinning, we can extract from those densities of states that are somewhat below 10 to the 13th. So we've achieved an order of magnitude, actually a little bit more than an order of magnitude reduction in the surface state density by putting on this special cap layer. So this does give us some indication that you can build an interface by using a special cap layer where you aren't restricted by the normal kinds of Fermi-level pinning. You now can have some control over that barrier height. This has been applied to the process of developing ohmic contacts. This was first reported in 95 in an applied physics letter by Pat Carr et al., where they built a structure that's that same cap layer on the top. It's a low-temperature grown gallium arsenide cap layer on the top with a thickness of a few nanometers. Underneath it is a very heavily doped N-type layer. Matter of fact, doped to about 10 to the 20th donors per cubic centimeter, which would normally be above the amphoteric limit in gallium arsenide. Normally, if you try to dope gallium arsenide N-type, by the time you get to about 5 times 10 to the 18th donors or silicon atoms per cubic centimeter, they start going both on donor and acceptor sites, so the net activated donor density is limited to about 5 times 10 to the 18th. In this case, in a thin region right below that low-temperature grown gallium arsenide layer, we believe that you're keeping the donors activated up to approximately 10 to the 20th. So you get two things out of this. You get good control of the surface Fermi-level position. You don't have the pinning there. And secondly, you actually get a very high activated donor density right underneath it. These are exactly what you want for good ohmic contact. You want a low barrier height, high doping density. And both of these happen. So the net effect is that even with as-deposited contacts, this study demonstrated you could get contact resistances, specific contact resistances, below 10 to the minus 6th. Results of a few times 10 to the minus 7th were reported. Okay, so that's part of the idea. You can actually now control with as-deposited contacts if you're willing to structure that surface correctly. So the final thing I'd like to talk about a little bit is thinking about some structures of interest for, say, molecular electronics or other interfacial structures. In particular, if you now looked at sort of a metal insulator semiconductor, or nominally sort of a metal insulator semiconductor, would you expect Fermi-level pinning at the semiconductor surface in those cases, and how could you control it in any case? Okay. So here's the kind of device structure we're looking at. This is actually drawn as a p-type semiconductor now, but it's the same basic idea. On the left, we have the metal. On the right, we have our semiconductor with some electron affinity. In this case, we also would think about an effective work function in the semiconductor that was approximately the vacuum level minus the Fermi level position. And in between now, we have a thin layer. In this case, many of the molecular layers that we're looking at are on the order of 1 to 2 nanometers thick. But the point is a thin layer of some material, such as a molecular layer, that give us a dielectric property there. So the question is, would you expect to have Fermi-level pinning present at the dielectric-to-semiconductor interface, and could you achieve an overall low barrier height in this kind of structure? Remember, we said a lot about the fact that Fermi-level pinning comes about because of a sheet of charge at the interface, and depending on which model you accept for Fermi-level pinning, you may or may not expect to see a large density of states there at that surface. So one of the things that happens is when you actually grow things like molecular monolayers on a surface, particularly on a semiconductor, you can exploit things like direct covalent bonds. This is actually an example from Adina Scott's work in my group, where in this case, on the lower right, we're illustrating that on a silicon surface, you can actually have a surface that starts out to be hydrogen terminated. And by electrochemistry, you can actually drive down molecules on the surface that will displace those hydrogen termination sites on certain silicon atoms and form a direct silicon to carbon bond. So you can actually now think about a chemical bond to your surface so that now it takes the place of things we talked about before. The example we talked about before of sulfur passivation on gallium arsenide relied on a chemical bond between the sulfur and the elemental atoms on the surface. And now you have a direct chemical bond plus a molecular tail to sort of give you some protection from the elements out there is one way to think about it. So now you can start thinking about a structure where we have the aspects of those passivation layers that we talked about before. You actually have direct chemical bonds on the surface that can lock up some of those dangling bonds or other surface states. So if you then try to look at device structures, we actually started looking at this a number of years ago, and actually started at very small size scales and have worked back out towards somewhat larger size scales. This is actually an example of an interface that applies those ideas. So this particular one has both the ideas in it. It has that cap layer of low-temperature grown gallium arsenide. That's the blue layer on the surface. It has the overall structure for that ohmic contact I talked about. It has a molecular monolayer on the surface, which should form a good chemical passivation layer on the surface and help lock up the excess dangling bonds. And in this case, it's actually using a top contact that's a 4-nanometer diameter metal nanocluster. So this winds up being a nanoscale contact. If you calculate the contact area of that cluster, it's about 10 to the minus 13 square centimeters, pretty small contact. And the IV curves are shown on the right, were actually acquired in Ron Reifenberger's lab here in physics. This shows that we have a specific contact resistance actually below 1 times 10 to the minus 7 ohm centimeter squared, which is a very good contact, and we see a maximum current density above 10 to the 7th amps per square centimeter through this thing. So actually, we've been able to achieve an extraordinarily good contact. And as I said, the rule of thumb for a good contact at any size scale is 10 to the minus 7 ohm centimeter squared. This one's better than that, and it happens in a freestanding 4-nanometer contact where you also have other effects of the surface around this thing. So it's actually indication, I think, that those interfaces have been controlled pretty well. If you try to now draw a band diagram for this thing, our metal semiconductor structure is on the left. This metal molecule semiconductor structure is on the right. What happens is you now drop a fair amount of potential across the molecular species. You have a barrier height within the semiconductor that should be fairly small because of the fact that we don't have to take the full built-in potential across the semiconductor surface anymore. We drop part of it across the molecule, part of it across the semiconductor portion. If you dope the semiconductor heavily enough or create enough states near the surface, perhaps by that low-temperature grown gallium arsenide, and if you consider the fact the molecule has a low dielectric constant, you would expect to drop most of the potential across the molecular layer and therefore get a very low effective barrier in the semiconductor. Okay. And then if you look at all this, you can start saying that one possible interpretation is that we actually have this very low surface barrier in the semiconductor region. It comes about because of that low dielectric constant in the molecular layer, but also it must correspond to a fairly low density of interface states there. And therefore, you can now form this tunneling contact. You've actually made the barrier in the semiconductor sufficiently low, you can tunnel through into that semiconductor. And this is a little bit contrary to this idea of Fermi-level pinning. If we go back to this idea of what would happen if you had large interface states there, on the left, we draw sort of a metal semiconductor structure, which looks like that ohmic contact we were talking about before with the low-temperature grown gallium arsenide on the surface. Excuse me. And there what we said was that you'd expect a certain built-in potential or certain barrier height across this thing, but that if you had large interface states, that would probably increase it to this pin position. On the right, we have sort of the same picture. The black curve sort of shows the metal insulator semiconductor structure, perhaps through that molecule, that's associated with no interfacial states. And then the red curve is what would happen if you actually did have this large density of interfacial states, which would do the same basic thing we talked about in the metal semiconductor. If there was a large density of interface states there, it would give you sort of an apparent discontinuity in the vacuum level. It would raise the effective barrier height at the semiconductor interface, and therefore you would still have a relatively large barrier to get through in the semiconductor. Now you have a large barrier in the semiconductor, you'd have a large barrier due to the molecule, and so this thing should conduct very poorly. So we could go into more details, but I think the basic message is that we likely have locked up the surface states there well enough between the chemical bonds and the presence of the organic tail there that we don't have significant reoxidation and significant surface states. Okay, so that's pretty much what I wanted to say. I think it's an interesting topic to think about these metal semiconductor contacts. We can learn a lot from what people have done in the past in trying to control these things for various device structures, but I think there's some intriguing new challenges coming about. Particularly, how do we control these interfacial barriers and stay consistent with the kinds of processing we need to do to take advantage of molecular and nanowire-type structures? So I'd just like to conclude by acknowledging some of our funding agents and also acknowledging some very interesting discussions with people like Professor Jerry Woodall, who's taught me most of what I know about metal semiconductor contacts, students like Saurabh Lodha and Stephen Howell, and Professor Supriyo Datta. And thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.